Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we'll hear about surprises at the Iowa caucuses. Two analysts share their views on trying to bring peace to Yemen. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee sits down with VOA to talk about Syria.
I certainly support diplomatic talks, as I think everyone would, but the elements at present do not feel like they're in their proper place.
And Rihanna releases her long-awaited album, Anti. It's right here on The Voice of America. Well, we had some surprises out in Iowa at the caucuses there. The Republicans and the Democrats, they were both starting out for the presidential contest. And covering it all was our correspondent, Jim Malone, who's on the line with us now. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
You had a late night last night and some real surprises, starting off with Trump.
Yeah, that's right. I think the air of invincibility that we'd seen for months in polling data was a bit pierced here in Iowa with a win by Ted Cruz. He went the traditional path of counting on especially conservative Christian voters. Trump, you know, underperformed a little bit. And then there was the surprising finish, strong finish of Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, right on Trump's heels. And that's going to really shake up the race.
And it looks like Clinton got a little bit of a scare over in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, a scare in one sense. I think the Bernie Sanders supporters are looking at it as a victory. I mean, it was basically a virtual tie. And now they head to New Hampshire, where Senator Sanders, who's of course from neighboring Vermont, has been very strong for months in the polls. And so it's going to be an uphill fight for Hillary Clinton to win in New Hampshire. She'll probably try to get closer to him. I think what it all means is the close finish in Iowa for the two Democrats means that the Democratic primary race is going to go on for quite a while. It's going to be a hard-fought, close contest for a bit. But Clinton at least can claim a very marginal victory there, and that, you know, avoiding a defeat, which I think would have been really difficult.
And we also lost two possible nominees.
Yeah, we did. Martin O'Malley on the Democratic side, who didn't really register much in Iowa or New Hampshire, is suspending his campaign. And Mike Huckabee, who's had made a second bid for the White House after falling short in 2008, Huckabee's leaving the race. I think, you know, once we get past New Hampshire next week, you could see kind of a crowded rush at the door because some of these folks just aren't going to make the cut. New Hampshire will be all about, by the way, finding the establishment alternative to Trump and Cruz. And Rubio right now is perhaps the leading contender for that, but he's going to have a lot of competition in New Hampshire from people like Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, and John Kasich.
Well, I was a little surprised, and I felt sorry for Jeb Bush because he really didn't do well. He's, as you know, Jim, the brother of a former president and the son of a former president, and it doesn't. Do you think he's going to make it at all?
You know, my colleague Mike Burke and I were out with him campaigning over the weekend in central Iowa, in a rural place, and he drew a small crowd. It was a nice exchange he had, but you didn't feel the passion. And if you go to some of the other events that we went to, a Ted Cruz rally, for example, there was quite a bit more intensity. And I think for whatever reason, this particular election cycle is not, you know, friendly to Jeb Bush. He doesn't appear to be the right fit for the kind of angry and, you know, aggressive Republican voters. They're looking for a different type of candidate.
Well, with this Trump not coming in first, do you think he knew that beforehand? Did you sense anything from his camp about the vote yesterday?
There was some low-key Trump that we haven't seen before. And he's getting some kudos for his sort of gracious, speech, acknowledging that he came in second. We'll see what happens in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is a state that has been very favorable to him so far in the polls. I think the question is, what kind of a bounce does Rubio get heading up to New Hampshire now? And even Cruz. Cruz is not a great fit for New Hampshire because he's very conservative, but You know, it's a very jumbled and kind of, you know, competitive Republican race right now, and I think a lot of different things could happen.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, for joining us after a late night for you last night.
Okay, Susan.
With a look at what's going on the web today concerning the Iowa caucuses is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky, and he joins me right here in the studio again. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what have you found out?
Well, there are a lot of interesting things coming out of the caucus. Of course, we have the results, and there's a lot of kind of Tuesday morning quarterbacking, we'll call it, from the different campaigns trying to spin the results as positive or negative. But then we have some interesting things like Sticker Boy, for instance.
Now,
this gentleman, it looks to be about the age of a college student, was standing behind Hillary Clinton when she was speaking last night and had put two Hillary Clinton stickers on his face and was kind of making these facial contortions. Well, he's become kind of an internet star now, people taking video of that, sharing it across social media, saying he was the real star of her speech, not her.
I don't think Hillary would agree with that one.
No, I don't think the campaign's very pleased about that. Another interesting thing that I've seen shared is that Twitter seemed to predict who the winners were. If you looked at the Twitter conversations leading up to the caucus results, people were talking a lot about Ted Cruz, and they were talking a lot about Hillary, but Hillary and Bernie were about neck and neck. Ted Cruz was getting more Twitter conversation than Donald Trump. Now, this is opposite of what Facebook predicted. Facebook said that Bernie and Trump were getting the most conversation. So people questioning which of those is perhaps the most reliable indicator, and it seems to be that it's Twitter.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the journal Science suggests that Babylonian astronomers from about 350 to 50 BC used some rather sophisticated geometric calculations to track the position and movement of the planet Jupiter. These new findings appear to contradict previously held beliefs that these complex mathematical techniques weren't developed until the 1400s by scholars in Oxford and Paris. The researchers were able to make their findings after analyzing several ancient cuneiform tablets. While the researchers didn't notice any drawings on the tablets, they did find some geometric calculations that pinpointed the position of Jupiter from when it was first seen on the horizon to where it would be 60 and 120 days later. The researchers say the calculations are based on the area of a trapezoid. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Yemen has experienced some of the fiercest fighting yet in its ongoing civil war between a Saudi-led coalition and Houthi rebels supported by forces loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Repeated violations of a ceasefire sponsored by the UN blocked resumption of talks that were scheduled to take place in mid-January. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with a couple of experts about failed attempts to negotiate an end to that conflict. And he joins me now. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Hey, Mohammed, what kind of answers did you get?
Well, some experts argue that the warring parties are trying to tip negotiations in their favor. For example, William Rowe, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, explains why the initial ceasefire was not adhered to.
The Saudis cannot, so far, accept a ceasefire that doesn't give them at least the appearance of a victory. And the Houthis cannot accept a ceasefire when they still control so much of the country.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon reiterated his deep concern over the continued conflict and called on all warring parties to commit to peace talks facilitated by the UN. Ambassador Rowe says the UN has tried since the middle of last year to broker a settlement but has not been able to persuade the warring parties to negotiate seriously. For Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution, the failure of the UN-sponsored talks was due to a flawed strategy.
There's no particular trust between the parties. There's no likely compromise outcome that they could all accept. There's no international mediator or peacekeeping or even observer force present. And in an intense wartime environment, that's never a very promising strategy.
So if that is the case, what kind of endgame do the experts perceive to end the conflict in Yemen?
Ambassador Roo says the Saudi-led coalition who intervened in March of 2015 is unable to win militarily despite the billions of dollars spent on that intervention. For him to end the conflict, Yemen needs a neutral mediator who can convince the various players to invest in peace instead. In trying to specify such mediator, Ambassador Roo believes that the United States has limited leverage over the warring parties, but he recommends an outside neutral mediator from the Gulf states.
I think the Omanis have the best chance of playing that role. But outside mediation isn't enough. The parties have to be willing to agree to a ceasefire, and the parties have to be willing to accept the terms of the mediation.
But O'Hanlon argues that the problem is not a neutral mediator, but rather the parties' distrust of each other. So he says the only way out is some sort of a conceivable end game or a political arrangement that both sides could accept.
At a minimum, the former government and the Houthi need to either agree on some kind of regionalization strategy, some kind of confederation strategy, or they need to come to the realization they're just not going to win in conquering the whole country and accept some kind of a soft partition as a fallback.
The other alternative for Michael O'Hanlon is an outside party to either intervene directly or radically increase its support for one side to end the stalemate by fundamentally changing the military dynamics on the battlefield. The two experts agree that a protracted conflict would only aggravate the mounting number of civilian casualties and worsen the already alarming humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
Thank you, Mohammed, for this analysis.
Thank you for having me, Sue.
Coming up on International Edition, a clip from an exclusive VOA interview and a new album from Rihanna. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker, voiced skepticism that Syrian peace talks will end fighting or lead to the voluntary departure of President Bashar al-Assad. Initial UN-mediated consultations in Geneva struggled to get underway one day after a suicide attack on a Shiite shrine in Syria left scores dead and in the midst of a renewed government offensive on rebel territory. Corker noted that rebel negotiators' basic conditions for launching the talks have not been met. Senate correspondent Michael Bowman spoke with VOA's Jim Stevenson on Monday about his exclusive interview.
Jim, we had a visit from the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Senator Bob Corker, right here at the VOA building, and I had a chance to speak with him. Right off the bat, this was happening as the initial effort was being made to get Syrian peace talks underway, and that didn't go so well. And in fact, Senator Corker told me that he's skeptical that these talks can end the conflict, number one, and number two, yield anything in terms of a transfer of power in Syria. He noted that as far as the talks go, that the government of Bashar al-Assad has yet to do even the most basic things requested by the opposition, such as releasing prisoners. And he also points out that there is no impetus on Assad to change course so long as he believes that he's winning on the battlefield. And indeed, his forces are doing better with the backing of Russia.
And let's hear a little bit from Senator Corker.
I certainly support diplomatic talks, as I think everyone would, but the elements at present do not feel like they're in their proper place. And what's been happening, as you know, is the facts on the ground have been changing. You have Russia that has intervened, and certainly the Assad regime, because of their support and Iranian support, have been making gains, and so pushing back against the Syrians. And as you change the facts on the ground in the way that they've been changed, it makes it very difficult to get to a place that looks satisfactory at present.
Do you envision President Assad ever leaving voluntarily?
At present, again, as he sees that he's making gains and as none of the things that the UN Security Council resolution stated have occurred, in other words, he's taken none of those steps. He hasn't quit barrel bombing his own citizens. He hasn't dealt with the humanitarian piece. He isn't dealing with this very low-level request. You would think that could easily be met. He's, the facts on the ground are moving in his direction, so it seems to me that he's not yet, the context is not there yet for him to do that.
We are speaking as the Iowa caucuses are about to begin, and in fact, all the Republican presidential candidates have been highly critical of the nuclear accord with Iran, and a few of them, some of Senator Corker's colleagues in the Senate, have pledged that if they win the presidency, that one of their first acts when they enter the White House will be to rip the Iran nuclear deal to shreds and yank the United States out of the accord. I asked Senator Corker whether that sort of snap your fingers, yank the United States out of the accord is really practical. I mean, this is something that the United States negotiated with all of its major allies.
We had an international coalition. As a matter of fact, I passed an amendment in one of the committees that focused on making sure that the sanctions that were put in place were international. So, again, I think what a new president is going to want to do is to, through the force of the presidency, which, let's face it, I mean, the United States is the greatest power on earth. We still have the ability to convene and lead, is to look at where the agreement is at the time and to try to move our partners along with us so that if we feel that what we have done is something that's going to lead to a nuclear weapon, and personally I think it does as it sits, then try to shift that direction. And probably the best way to do it is not just to come in and rip it, but to assess and move ahead based on where we are at the time.
Stop by voanews.com to read more and see the interview with U.S. Senator Bob Corker. This is VOA.
This is Green Beat for a healthier planet.
Orangutans found only in the wild in Indonesia and Malaysia are an endangered species, largely due to poaching and habitat loss. Orangutans, though, in central Borneo are facing another threat.
Forest areas along the Mangkutub River have been destroyed as a result of recent forest fires, making it difficult for orangutans to find food, and this is very dangerous for them.
Ahmed Soyoko is with the Borneo Survival Foundation. He and other conservationists are relocating orangutans who live in central Kalimantan, Indonesia. Soyoko says they cannot rescue all of the great apes, but they are moving as many as they can 6 hours downriver. Often called the people of the forest, orangutans used to number in the tens of thousands in parts of Borneo and Sumatra. But conservationists say their populations have decreased by as much as 50% over the last 60 years. Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
R&B and hip-hop star Rihanna has released her long-awaited album, Anti. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the album and why it took so long to release and what fans can look forward to from Rihanna.
Rihanna's long-awaited album, Anti, is finally out. VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee is here. Shauna, first of all, let's start off. Why did this take so long to get this album done?
I wish I could answer that question for you. I don't know. We never got a clear answer from Rihanna or anyone in her camp. The only thing that I can assume based on what I've been reading over the last year is that Rihanna wanted to take her time to create what she was calling a classic album, one that would withstand the test of time. And so I think anytime you go into the studio or you begin a creative project with that in mind, you have to take a little more time than normal. I think she knows very well how to bang out what they call a radio hit, something that she can release. It'll go straight to the charts. Everybody will love it for about 6 or 7 months, and then she'll release another one that will replace that. This album is nothing like what we have heard from her in the past. And so I imagine that that is a big part of it. Also, she has done something very interesting in terms of releasing this album. I know we talked a while ago about this deal that she signed with Samsung, and there were no real details at that time, but we know now that she worked with Samsung to create this website called Anti-Diary. And so they have all of these virtual rooms that over the last few months you had to go through to get codes, and then the last room would give you a code in which you could use to download the entire album for free. So I imagine that that may have also been why it took a little longer than anticipated to release the album.
Going to make you work for it to get to all the cuts. Have you heard any of the cuts on this album?
I've not heard the whole thing because I don't have the code, but I've been able to listen to, I think I heard about 7 or 8 cuts. Interesting, she released 3 songs last year. She released American Oxygen, 4 or 5 Seconds. That was the one with Paul McCartney and Kanye West. Be Better Have My Money. We all assumed those songs would be on the album. They are not. So these are all new songs. I heard the first single, which is Work with Drake. That was released on Wednesday. I've heard a couple of other ones. A lot of ballads, kind of slow and mid-tempo cuts on this album versus what we're used to. She's
No EDM, no electronic dance music.
Right. She's well known for EDM. She's well known for her reggae-influenced cuts or her hip-hop-inspired cuts. They're there, but not to the degree that we've known and heard in the past.
Now, can people look to hear Rihanna on the Soul Lounge?
Well, we will be playing that one cut Work this week, absolutely. And as the albums are released, you know, we have to play by the rules here. So as the label releases the songs, of course, I'll be playing each and every one of them that I get my hands on.
All right. Well, if you would like to send a tweet to Shauna, she is at VOA Lady DJ. You can also find her at the Soul Lounge. That's on our website, voanews.com. And you can also hit us up. We are at @VOA_IE.
Now looking back to 2005 when Rihanna came on the scene, Pawn the Replay was her first big hit. Thanks for listening to International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent trip to Cambodia, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry expressed his hope that Cambodia will realize the full benefits of a thriving multi-party democracy. He said the U.S. cares deeply about respect for human rights, universal freedoms, and good governance. And progress in each of these areas is really critical to being able to fulfill the potential of our bilateral relations, but also, importantly, the full potential of the hopes and aspirations of the Cambodian people. In his discussions with Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, Secretary Kerry further stressed that democratic governments have a responsibility to ensure that all elected representatives are free to perform their responsibilities without fear of attack or arrest. This includes opposition party leader Samrong Si, who was forced into exile after the government called for his arrest for allegedly defaming Foreign Minister Hau Nam Hong. So as Cambodians prepare for elections next year, and again in 2018, it is very important to allow for vigorous but peaceful debate. The U.S. remains interested in developing its economic relations with Cambodia. Indeed, the United States is Cambodia's largest single-country export market today. Last November, both countries held their first competitiveness and growth dialogue. Now, said Secretary Kerry, we look forward to trade and investment framework agreement talks that will take place soon, and we will continue to explore ways to deepen our trade and investment relationships, including by helping to tackle corruption and exploring ways to strengthen Cambodia's legal institutions. To that end, the United States looks forward to welcoming Cambodia to the U.S.-ASEAN summit in February. A thread of common concern to both the U.S. and Cambodia is countering violent extremism, Prime Minister Hun Sen expressed interest in Cambodia working with the U.S.-led coalition against Daesh. The U.S. also cooperates with Cambodia on other issues, including health and food security and mine clearance. There are active Fulbright and Peace Corps programs on the ground in Cambodia, and the U.S. continues to help with sustainable development in the Mekong River region. The U.S. remains deeply committed to its partnership with Cambodia and with all the members of ASEAN on a regional and global basis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.